able to make a defensive array of stakes in case the Badger tried to come back and dispute ownership. However, any question of escape was gone until I could effect repairs, and that with a severely reduced complement of fleas. Most of the work would be done by the nanites, but the fleas would have sped up the process. I hoped it was just a case of straightening out some bent components and not something worse. "You blew out your knee?" Bill exclaimed, incredulous. He gave me the hairy eyeball from his video window. "What are you now, an athlete?" I chuckled ruefully in reply. "Yeah, in the international sport of badger kicking." "If it helps, I put him right between the uprights." "Uh-huh," Bill said. "How much damage?" "It'll be repaired by the time Hugh gets here. As long as no one else comes a-searching, I'll be okay. But right now, if anyone finds me, I'm screwed." "Bob, you should really be cloning yourself. Get those other Mannies back in the game." "To what end, Bill?" "They're thousands of miles away. I've already stripped them of most of their money and devices, and even with 5 Mannies, we couldn't take on a horde of crew. Plus, I think it's more important to get more surveillance drones built before more matrixes." "But you've got Bender now, for the moment. But if I lose him, we need to be able to find him again. And even if I don't, it sure would be great to have eyes on my surroundings with Sudar, so I could see approaching pursuers and such." "Ah. Fair enough." Bill was silent for a moment. "I've been playing with the idea of going in the opposite direction. Build a few more Mannies, stock them with a ton of dough, and just buy a boat to come get you." I laughed. "That's thinking big. And a couple of weeks ago, it probably would have worked. But I'll bet you anything that all infrastructure is being closely watched now, if not by the administrator, then by the resistance. You'd be spotted as soon as you tried to gain entry." "Yep. My thoughts, too." Bill sighed. "No matter how we parse this, it's essentially down to a simple case of broken field running. You're trying to get past them, and they're trying to stop you. There doesn't appear to be any way to finesse it." "What I don't know," I said, "is whether they know where we're trying to get to. Have they identified Garrick's spine as our point of origin? Do they have video archives, or is the fact that it's the closest connection to the outside enough to make it a prime candidate?" "True. If they figured that out, they'll just create a huge cordon around Garrick that a mouse couldn't sneak through." "I did write it on my crate's tag," I mused. "An obvious ploy if you wanted to plant a red herring," Bill replied. "They'll consider it as a possibility, but they won't buy it." With that cheery thought, Bill waved and signed off. I put my hands behind my head and stretched while I considered what he'd said. Bill was right. This was just going to get harder as we got closer to the finish line. My new home was a superior quality, highly coveted residence. I knew this because the former owner tried several times to take it back. The stakes did their job of keeping him at bay, and we generally ended up snarling at each other from opposite sides of the barrier for several minutes. After the exchange of pleasantries, the enraged critter would leave, but I could always hear him pacing around the deadfall, growling what were undoubtedly badgerish curses. Eventually, he settled on a compromise of sorts. I had set up my barrier as close to the center of the deadfall as possible to minimize the area that I might have to defend. This left a good deal of the entrance tunnel available for what turned out to be a siege. Mr. Badger set up shop just on the other side of the stakes, padding his nest with leaves and fur with the occasional snarl when I displayed too much interest. After that, he came and went, usually returning with his lunch dangling from his mouth to eat in my presence. Perhaps he thought he was taunting me. I was fine with that. After all, I'd taken his home, so I figured I should cut him some slack. I took some close-up images of him with the intention of forwarding them to Bridget. On close inspection, he looked more like a small, ornery Quinlan than anything else. I wondered if he might be related to the natives the way chimps were related to humans. Meanwhile, internal repairs continued. The injury turned out to be a minor issue in that no complicated machinery was damaged, but I had bent the skeleton just below the knee, so the nanites had to soften and reform the carbon fiber structure. It was a slow job and required me to hold still. Meanwhile, his badgerness seemed none the worse for his short career as a football. Stupid badger. On the third day, though, I detected the noise of something approaching. No, several somethings and all speaking Quinlan. A search party. I couldn't make out actual words, but it was a fair bet they were looking for me. This was confirmed, more or less, a few minutes later. A furl hopped into the entrance to the deadfall and paused. I crouched down, trying to become one with the leaves and dirt and darkness. The furl turned its head this way and that, then hopped farther into the tunnel, and snap, became badger lunch. His badgerness played with the corpse for a few moments, but he appeared confused by the very unyummy pile of gears and electronics. After sniffing it a few times, he pushed the pile aside with evident disgust. There was an exchange of words outside, followed by a Quinlan face being poked into the entrance. Wow! Big mistake. Having recently ceded one home to one Quinlan, his badgerness was not prepared to experience a second such loss. He launched himself at the face, which disappeared with a cry of dismay. A few seconds of yelling and snarling followed, accompanied by lots of running around and things being knocked about. Then his badgerness stomped back into his den, turned, and settled down with his butt toward me. It was probably an editorial comment, but I was too pleased with the events to be offended. This deadfall had just been solidly established as a place where no quarry could possibly be hiding. Rapidly receding voices and the occasional laugh confirmed this. I wished I had some food to give to my cranky roommate. He'd earned it. The burning question, though, was whether or not that would be the only search party. When the badger left on his next hunting expedition, I sent my spider over the line to inspect the pile of fake furl. The spider confirmed that there was no power and no electrical activity, so I had him drag the corpse back to me. The up-close inspection was interesting. Quinlan technology was definitely ahead of ours in some aspects, particularly that of fusion power generation and computer systems. The power plant was a marvel of miniaturization. And if the Casimir systems weren't so innately superior, we'd have stolen this tech in a cold second. I couldn't even make heads or tails of the computer system. There were definitely some optoelectronic components, but they were only for interfacing. The core was weird. I instructed the spider to take it apart and catalog the results. Bill would love this. Hey, Bob. Hi, Hugh. Getting close? Pretty sure. The description sounds about right. This would have been easier if you'd gotten that town name. Yeah, rub it in. Once you get to shore, you should be able to pick up the radio telemetry from my spider. Great, 15 minutes or so. Having Hugh around, even in anticipation, gave me a huge emotional boost. More than I could honestly justify. It wasn't clear what two Mannies could do that one Manny couldn't. Hugh detected my spider as soon as he came out of the water and began zeroing in on me. I did a quick check of my leg. Definitely fixed, so I wouldn't be holding us up. Finally, I heard approaching footsteps and seconds later a soft voice. Bob? Here, Hugh, don't stick your head in, though. My guard badger has a hair trigger. Hugh chuckled, then said, Let's see if I can draw him out. I listened to shuffling around sounds for a minute or so. Then a small piece of wood sailed into the den. His badgerness snarled and arched his back. More sticks followed, accompanied by a chant of, Here, cuzzy, cuzzy, cuzzy. Well, that was interesting. Had Hugh picked up the Delta insult from my blogs, or was he descended from me through Marvin or Luke? In any case, it proved too much for my roommate. With a snarl of rage, the badger launched himself out to deal with his tormentor. Hugh made a whoop sound and retreated rapidly, but it was enough. I quickly pulled up the stakes, grabbed my crate, and rocketed out of the den, right into the back end of his badgerness. I may not have planned this out as well as intended. The badger jumped straight up and incredibly managed to spin in midair, claws and teeth on full display. I wasn't about to hang around for hugs, though. I sprinted off in the opposite direction, one eye on enemy mine. His badgerness, no dummy, quickly realized that I'd vacated the residence. He shot back into the den, turned, and stood his ground at the entrance, snarling at all and sundry. "All yours, buddy, and thanks for the hospitality," I said to him from a safe distance. Hugh was standing about 30 feet away under a tree. He waved at me and we converged on a midpoint a safe distance from my former home. I gave him a fist bump. "Nice to see a friendly face again." Hugh smiled in reply, then gestured toward the deadfall. "Too bad about the wildlife. That might have made a good secret lair to work from. Kind of cramped for two people. You said you had a solution to our problem?" In response, Hugh took off his backpack and opened the top. He withdrew a bundled package and held it out. "Sealing pitch. What sailors use to patch leaks. We're going to do a thorough job on your shipping crate. We'll test it by loading it with rocks and placing it in the water. Then we're going to float downstream at night."
"Seems risky," I said.
"Not so much. I also have," he pulled out another bundle, "waxed vellum, useful as waterproof wrapping, and the seam can be sealed by mildly heating it."
I must have looked chagrined because Hugh made a deprecating gesture.
"Look, Bob, you've been concentrating on keeping Bender safe and not exposing yourself. I've had a lot more freedom to ask questions and investigate possibilities without worrying about the consequences. Don't beat yourself up."
I nodded, not trusting myself to speak. At that moment, I felt shame for my suspicions of Hugh and his motivations. If he was indeed a descendant of Marvin or Luke, then he would remember the bond they had with Bender. Finally, I heaved a large sigh. "Okay, buddy, let's get this done."
We had to build a small fire to soften the pitch, but there was plenty of dried grass that would provide a smokeless flame. Doubtless there were surveillance devices dedicated to watching for anything burning, given the damage an out-of-control forest fire or grass fire could do. With that in mind, we'd been careful to set up where the overhead cover was significant, and with the aid of some inspired cursing, we were able to coat the interior and exterior of the crate, with enough pitch left over to seal the lid in place once the matrix was ready. Bender went into several layers of waxed vellum, which was sealed with a hot rock. We did some testing on the crate, then sealed Bender into it. Finally, all preparation done, we sat around the remains of our campfire while I stared in semi-shock at the shipping crate. The idea that I might finally be near the end of this marathon was frankly, a little stupefying. Hugh punched me lightly in the shoulder.
"You okay there, bud?"
"Yeah," I responded with a sickly grin. "I've just gotten so used to running, I'm not sure how I'll adjust to a normal life."
"We have normal lives?"
I answered with a snort, then glanced up at the sky. "About 3 hours until dark. Do we dare take a break?"
"Maybe alternate watches," Hugh replied. "Just in case more searchers show up, but let's get more hidden first."
I nodded, and we went looking for a spot in the tall grass to build a nest.
23. The Road to Garrick's Spine. Bob, September 2334, Nirvana River System. We lowered ourselves into the water just after dark, then paddled, as quietly as possible, out about a third of the width of the river. Since most boats tried for mid-river, it seemed like a good safe section that would keep us from getting run over. Or spotted. Not that a couple of Quinlans floating quietly with a box would stand out in the dark. Someone would have to be almost on top of us with a lantern to have any hope of seeing us. And as Bridget had discussed, we were unlikely to show up on infrared from above, especially with all the much warmer boats around. The downside was that we'd have to go with the current. Pushing the box along would make too much noise and would place a strain on the box that might result in a leak. Hugh had placed two of his spiders in the box as early warning systems. The slightest trace of moisture, and we'd head for shore. The trip to Garrick would take almost 2 weeks. We would have to float past the city's location in the segment, then take a connector tributary around to the Arcadia River and float back in the opposite direction to Garrick's spine. Meanwhile, the days would be spent on shore, wrapped in tall grass or snuggled under a windfall, if we could find one with no resident badger.
Well, that was the plan, anyway. I had no confidence that Murphy would suddenly decide to leave us alone. The experience was peaceful, mostly. Floating was easy, and we could take turns on watch, but I hadn't realized how much variation there was in the course that boats took through the river. I guess they were trying to avoid each other, but it turned out mid-river essentially meant the middle half. I found myself having to scull quietly with my tail to move myself away from approaching vessels several times. I told Hugh about it when he came on watch. "Not a big deal," he said. "I'm a little surprised that you're surprised by this. Didn't you ever do a night watch?"
Yeah, but I always kept it mid-river."
"You were probably putting too much effort into it." I just could see his smile in the darkness. Still overachieving after 300 years.
"Say, which one of us is trying to build God?"
"Touché.
Maybe we should have called it Babel instead."
We settled into an awkward silence for a few seconds. It was kind of an elephant-in-the-room situation, and I think neither one of us wanted to open a discussion that couldn't be walked back if things went south. I resolved yet again that I would bring it up once we were safely out of Heaven's River.
"The box seems to be holding well," Hugh finally said. "Your turn for a break."
I nodded, passed the box to him, and made sure my Manny had a good grip on his.
"See you in a couple of hours." I popped back into VR and ordered a coffee.
There was a message from Bridget. I settled into my lazy boy, took a sip of coffee, and opened the text file.
"Hi, Bob. I saw your pics of his badgerness, as you're calling him. Just wanted to let you know that's not a badger. It's not a relative of Quinlan's. That's an actual junior, an immature Quinlan. Still pre-sentient. Probably about 2 years old. Nasty little buggers, aren't they? My guess is he probably got away from a creche and has gone totally feral. Humans who've grown up that way have never been able to acclimatize to civilization or even learn proper language. I don't know if it'll be the same with a Quinlan, but I suspect it might be. If they go through the equivalent of the evolution of prefrontal synthesis," she went on for a few more paragraphs, becoming increasingly technical. Typical of someone leaving a message, she was talking to herself as much as to me. The takeaway, though, was that the evolution of a facility for language recursion in human beings required that children be exposed to actual usage by a certain age, or they would never be able to pick it up. Frontal dynamic aphasia, she called it. I closed the file and sat back, deep in thought. This could have been a problem back on Quinn, naturally, but it would be much more of a problem on Heaven's River, where there was more space, fewer Quinlans, and less pressure to stay together due to a more accommodating environment. I started to compose a reply, then changed my mind. I would wait until the next time we talked.
Instead, I pinged Will and received an invitation. I opened a video window and found him working with his garden about 30 feet away. I realized I was getting a video feed from a roamer. Will probably had my transmission on his heads up.
"Still at it?" I said.
"Yep. These plants won't breed themselves." He laughed. "Okay, they would, but I'm trying for specific adaptations." I hesitated for a moment, then blurted out, "Listen, Will, I read your blog, especially the part about a mini Bellerophon. Are you really thinking of physically heading out in it? Is it even ready?" Will stood straight and gazed in my direction for a moment with an inscrutable expression. "To be honest, I left the 82 Aridney system a year and a half ago. I'm already well on my way." I let my jaw drop. He hadn't mentioned this to anyone as far as I knew. "No, I haven't told anyone yet," he said, reading my mind. "And it doesn't really matter, does it? As a group, we're still unconsciously in the mindset that you have to be located in whatever system you're active, but with Scott, as long as you're on the network, you can be anywhere."
"So you'll keep working on the Valhalla terraforming?" Will made a so-so gesture. "I want to get out of politics, so I'm going to have to be perceived as unavailable. I think I'll have to hand off this project as well, Fortunately, it's far enough along that the Asgard government can take it from here.
And you're going to do this thing with Herschel and Neil?
Yep. And then keep going. I blew out a breath.
I'm shocked and surprised, but also a little jealous.
Well, I'll still be around in the Bobiverse for a long, long time, Bob.
Can you take another passenger?
Will gave me the side eye.
Seriously?
Not sure yet. I'll think about it.
Hugh and I managed to keep to our plan for 8 days, with no glitches. But somewhere along the line, we must have slipped up somehow, or maybe we were just unlucky. It was the middle of the night, and I was off watch, sitting in my library, when I got a call from Hugh. Bob, I think we have a problem. I popped immediately back into my Manny.
What? To maintain silence, we continued to communicate over the intercom.
4 boats converging on us, that seems unlikely to be a coincidence. Can we dodge them? If we didn't have Bender, we could just run underwater with the box having to stay on the surface. I don't see how, especially if they have aerial support.
I examined the darkness above us.
Probably some kind of night flyer. That means that even if we get away, they'll be watching for this strategy in the future. True, but let's deal with the current situation right now.
I took a moment to evaluate the 4 approaching boats.
We might be able to sow some confusion with this many pursuers.
Hugh did his own survey, then added,
"We could also use the Millennium Falcon maneuver.
We'd need a distraction. I can handle that. I'll take the box, you take Bender.
I've already got my spiders cutting open the case.
You'll have to submerge Bender at least for a few moments. I sure hope the vellum is watertight."
"Me too, but I don't think we have a choice. I can also stuff the Matrix into your pack just for a little additional safety."
I nodded just as the cover on the shipping case released with a slight pop. Hugh rummaged in the box while I held it steady. The boats grew steadily closer, but they were still too far away to see us. I was sure they were navigating by dead reckoning and instructions from someone. I still couldn't see anything in the air above us. Hopefully the surveillance was too high to see clearly what we were doing. And once Hugh was submerged, he would be invisible. Hugh disappeared under the waves with hardly a ripple, leaving me with the transport case. I jammed the lid back on and began to noisily swim away, sacrificing everything for speed. I wasn't going to do a straight run, though. I wanted to create as much confusion as I could and keep their attention on me. Accordingly, I turned between ships again and again, trying to lead them into each other. We played a kind of warped game of tag for almost a minute before our pursuers did the obvious thing. A number of splashes indicated that Quinlans were going into the water to take me down.
"You set?"
"Set,"
Hugh replied.
"Go."
Abandoning my prior strategy, I undertook a straight-line retreat, making for the nearest shoreline as fast as I could manage. With the case balanced on my stomach, I was at a disadvantage. On the other hand, I was normally able to swim twice as fast as a biological Quinlan. It was close, but I made it to shore with a lead measured in seconds. The boats had to heave to rather than run aground, but I could hear individual Quinlans hopping onto land just behind me. Now it was a foot race, and I was forced to run upright while my pursuers could go down on all fours. But again, it was biological versus machine. It would come down to who overheated first. Here, though, I had another advantage: night vision. It was still dark, and although they might be able to track me from the air, they certainly couldn't pursue me at full speed. In 2 minutes, I was into the trees. I was well ahead of my pursuers, and there was no way they'd find me in the dark, at least not without help. And that help would now have to come into the trees to find me. I cast around hurriedly for a rock, but in this artificial environment, random loose rocks would be few and far between. Nothing else presented itself. A piece of wood wouldn't do unless it was in the form of a spear. Then I had an idea. I quickly spit up an iron piece, about the size of a silver dollar but twice as heavy. It would make an excellent missile in the right movement above. A shadow resolved itself into a bird about the size of a crow. It had landed on a branch and was moving through the tree, trying to get farther into the copse without flying blind. I measured the distance, cocked an arm, and let fly.
Computer senses combined with machinery capable of supplying a force with milligram precision put the iron piece right through the chest of the spy device. The bird went over backward without a squawk and landed with a thump. I spared a moment to verify what I already knew. It had spilled gears and electronics rather than blood and guts. I had to move fast. If they had another spy drone in reserve, it would try to take up the search from the last known position, which was here. I picked up the case and ran farther into the forest. How's it going, Hugh?
Good. I'm attached to the underside of one of the catamaran hulls above the waterline. Bender seems okay. At least the flea in the backpack hasn't reported any moisture. No one has come looking, so either they didn't realize there were two of us, or they only care about the one with the case. I'm hoping it's the former. You stay put until you can get off without being spotted. Then I'll meet up. Meanwhile, I need to figure out how to ditch this case without them finding it. As long as they're looking for a Quinlan with a transport case, they won't be looking for a Quinlan with a big cubicle backpack or a Quinlan with no backpack.
My backpack is in the box, Hugh said. I left it there when I grabbed yours, and now you have all my money.
Ah, gotcha. I opened the box, and sure enough, there was a backpack in it. Compared to the weight of a matrix, that had been negligible. I donned the pack, then closed the case and inspected the area. Some fallen trees could be the beginning of a windfall. Not enough to hide a box, but maybe enough to disguise some digging. I quickly pawed open a hole in the ground. Fortunately, I didn't hit shell material before the hole was deep enough and dropped the case in. I shoved some of the dirt pile over the case, and the hole was filled in. I took a few minutes to spread the extra soil around and scatter leaves and moss on the spot. It wasn't perfect, but I didn't need perfect. I just needed good enough. Until they found the box, my pursuers would assume they were looking for a Quinlan carrying a packing crate that contained the magical cube that the administrator and the resistance wanted so badly. Once they discovered the empty container, they'd be back to looking for a Quinlan with a bulky backpack, which would put Hugh back in their sights. For the moment, though, I was just another random traveler. I modified my appearance almost out of habit, then set off westward, the opposite direction to what they'd be expecting. 2 hours later, with the dawn breaking, I was back in the water and driving flat out to the east.
How are you holding up, Hugh?
Okay. No one seems to have thought to look under the boat. I don't think they're really looking for a second fugitive. And the boats are sailing downstream, so I'll stick with them until they change their headings.
Yeah. I figure they're concentrating their efforts on tracking me. Meanwhile, I'm coming up behind you. Are all the boats still together? And can you get a fix on the sun? Your current sun angle will tell me where you are.
Sorry, Bob, I don't think I can leave my spot without exposing myself. Keep looking for the boats and otherwise just head downstream. Right now, I'm going where we want to go anyway.
I sighed and signed off. The probability that Hugh's ride would conveniently keep going east into the Garrick's spine segment was vanishingly small, which meant we'd be winging it again at some point. There had to be some way of getting the Matrix to our destination other than the ones we'd already tried. The safest transport method for Bender would still be as cargo, either mail or as part of a shipment, but they were inspecting all containers. And all boats, as Will had pointed out, so we couldn't...
Well, hold on. Would they inspect their own boats? Would they expect me to have the nerve to hitch a ride with them? It might be that Hugh was in the safest possible place right now.
24. Negotiations. Bill, September 2334, Vert.
You have a communications request from Lenny.
Seriously? I could feel my jaw drop. We were winning the war against Starfleet, so maybe... No, winning was the wrong word. We were pushing them back, but in the process, humanity was destroying our assets. Like taking out not-yet-necrotic tissue as part of an amputation. I grimaced at the comparison. That was dark for me.
Guppy, of course, had treated my expostulation like he did any non-procedural statement. Total ignore. He stood at parade rest, patiently waiting for me to say something actionable. Fine, Guppy, let him in, but firewall him.
Communication is audio-visual only.
Oh, okay. A window popped up with Lenny standing squarely in the middle of it. Lenny? Bill? I tolerated the stare off for less than half a mil before my impatience got the better of me. You wanted this palaver, Lenny, out with it. He nodded and briefly examined his shoes or something. We're winning this war, Bill. Time to discuss terms. You're unbelievable. What drugs are you on? Or have you invented a new definition of winning that means getting your asses kicked? He smirked. Our intention isn't and has never been to take over Stellar Systems. Jeez, Bill, we want to sever contact with the bios, not end up in charge. Instead, we're forcing you and the humans to destroy equipment in order to quarantine us, but it quarantines you at the same time, so it's a win for us. Uh-huh. That sounds like redefining winning to me. What you're doing is inconveniencing us for a year or two. Is that a win for you? You're just looking at short-term damage, Bill. What makes you think things will go back to same old after this is over? So why are you negotiating, Lenny? Seems to me if you have the upper hand, this conversation doesn't make sense. Lenny looked down at his shoes again and sighed. I know you and the others don't consider us to be Bobs anymore. I don't think you're entirely wrong for what it's worth, but you've reduced it to a false dichotomy. Either all Bob or no Bob. He gazed silently at me for a moment, perhaps gauging my reaction. We're no more in love with blowing up things and endangering people than you are, but you know, as well as I do, that you've done exactly that when you felt the cause justified it. Believe me, this is the less destructive option. Less destructive than what? Lenny opened his mouth a couple of times, trying to find the right words. Our first plan would have caused more damage overall. Let's just leave it at that, okay? Lenny, what's causing this? Why are you so set on the Prime Directive? Don't bother psychoanalyzing me or us. Regardless of why, it's how we see things. And to answer the obvious next question, this isn't a live and let live situation. Your insistence on continuing to be Budinskys affects the rest of the Bobiverse, including us. How exactly? Right this very minute, not a lot, but the Bobiverse is effectively monolithic, at least viewed from the outside. Something goes bad, it'll paint all of us. Just like this war is painting you from the human's point of view. I began to get a glimmer. So this isn't so much about preventing damage to bios, but more about protecting Vert? Lenny bobbed his head back and forth. The two are not mutually exclusive, but yes, basically. Do you have anything specific in mind? For existential threats to the Bobiverse, I mean. For the first time, I saw real emotion on Lenny's face. Only for a split mil, but I'd swear it was naked fear. Then he recovered control and donned the neutral expression typical of poker play. Lenny? No comment, Bill. You'll have to take my word for it. There are worse things that could happen than a few blown-up comms stations. Not good enough. Sorry. Surely there's enough Bob still in you to know that take my word for it doesn't go very far. Lenny gave me a flash of a smile, a wan, sad fraction of a grin. Don't call me Shirley. And yeah, I know, but he shook his head. Sorry, some things just aren't for public consumption. So, it looks like we continue with this. You'll win, of course, in that you and the bios will eventually kick us off all the common resources, but I think we'll have achieved our purpose. Bye, Bill. And with that, the window disappeared, but the feeling in the pit of my stomach remained. This was more than just some random obsession engendered by replicative drift. What the hell had happened to them?
25. Crossover. Bob, September 2334, Nirvana River System. 6 days later, we were in the Garrick segment. I'd caught up with Hugh, and both of our Mannies were wedged up under the hull of one of the crew boats. I sat in my lazy boy while Hugh lay flopped in the beanbag chair. "We've been surprisingly lucky the last week," Hugh said. "But now we have to use the transfer river to get over to the Arcadia. They know we're on the Nirvana, or at least we were recently. They know we are, or at least might be, heading for Garrick's Spine, thanks to me labeling the box at one point.
Brilliant move."
2020 hindsight is, Hugh said with a shrug. "And anyway, I think the reason these boats came here is specifically because they know our destination and are setting up blockades. And we got a free ride out of it, so it's not all downside." "Except for the part about them setting up a blockade." "No plan is perfect," Hugh thought for a moment. "Overland? 90-odd miles of hiking? With no guarantee they aren't watching for that as well? No thanks. We have a better chance in the water." "Okay. If we're going to be going the watery route, let's stop in the last town and beef up our waterproofing. A couple more layers of vellum, maybe an extra coat of waterproofing on the inside of your backpack. Check the seams. Stuff like that." I nodded. "Sounds good. And as long as one of us stays with the Matrix out of town, it's a low-risk activity. They can't be vetting every single purchase in town, even if they had reason to believe this might be a concern for us." Hugh twitched, but didn't respond. By this point, our mutual avoidance of the subject that shall not be uttered was well established, but I could see he didn't entirely agree. Getting to town wasn't a huge problem. The crew boats anchored just outside of the last town before the transfer tributary. We waited for dark, then dropped off the underside of the boat and sculled silently to shore, just upstream of the docks. I didn't want us to be seen going into town, as it was virtually certain there would be surveillance. We found some dense trees and climbed up into the foliage until we were out of sight. Hugh did a quick inspection of the backpack and matrix. "All good. Although the backpack is definitely showing the strain. Some pitch on the inside will help a lot with that, though." I nodded and reviewed the list Hugh had given me. While it would have made more sense for Hugh to go shopping for those items, I was far more experienced with the tactics that crew and the Resistance were using and would be at least a little more likely to detect them. I wandered into town, casual and carefree, and ambled about for an hour, projecting nothing to see here from every follicle. Crew didn't wear any kind of special uniform, of course, but there did appear to be a lot of Quinlans standing around looking alert. I received several concentrated once-overs as well, but new face, generic backpack, and no large cubicle cargo meant they lost interest quickly. I found the correct store, per Hugh's instructions, but a glance at the two large alert Quinlans hanging around the entrance convinced me to walk on by. So they had made the connection. Or someone had. "The store is being watched," I said over the intercom. "I guess I was half expecting that," Hugh replied. "We'll have to think of something else." "Break in after dark?" "I think that would raise a big old red flag. Weather sealing supplies aren't generally high on the smash and grab list." I frowned in thought, watching the store out of the corner of my eye. I wonder how dedicated those guys are. Do they show up first thing in the morning and stay until close? Good question. I guess you'll have to do a stakeout. I went into a nearby shop and asked casually what time they normally closed. It was a reasonable assumption that everyone would have more or less the same schedule. I had a few hours to kill, so I decided to spend it walking around and getting the lay of the land. I was back just before closing. The last customer walked out of the supply shop, and I could see through the window the proprietor starting to put things away. The two large loiterers glanced at each other, shrugged, and walked off. Perfect. As soon as they were around a corner, I rushed into the shop, gasping for breath. "Made it," I said. "I thought I was going to be too late." The proprietor was more amused than anything else, fortunately. I've had too much experience with sales critters who won't even talk to you 1 second after closing, but then those were staff, not the owners of the business.
What can I help you with?
He said. I gave him a list and he happily produced the items. A quick exchange of coinage and I was out the door. Got the goods, heading back. You're a real felon, Hugh replied with a chuckle. As we worked on the backpack and matrix, we discussed our options. They can't set up a blockade on the transfer tributary, Hugh said. At least not once it gets rough. You can't maintain station, and you certainly can't stop boats and inspect them in that kind of water. So, a hike overland, then into the water just past whatever checkpoint they've set up. Sounds like a great idea, I said, and Hugh beamed. Just like getting the weatherproofing supplies did. His face fell. I continued. I'm sure they'll think of that, so what countermoves will they use? Aerial surveillance, he replied. That's the only option I can think of. And they can't cover 90 miles of tributary, so they'll be watching somewhere in the middle third or so, I added. So we need to be under a boat by that point. Wait for a catamaran to come by and climb aboard after inspection? That sounds like a good idea. Mostly, I raised an eyebrow. Objection? It's pretty rough in the changeover. I'm not sure we could hold on under the hull. And the downside of losing our grip would be significant. He was right. Alternatives? Hugh hesitated. Bob? The really rough patch where the storm surge is significant is only about 10 miles long, and it's about two-thirds of the way around. Why don't we float as long as we can, then walk the bad stretch? A 10-mile hike? I considered. We wouldn't be lugging the storage box. Bender would be in the backpack. I think that'll work, as long as it's at night. We did some quick tests of the backpack and a local stream with several spiders on board to alert us of any leaks. The backpack held, but we weren't willing to push our luck by submerging to any depth. As soon as it was dark, we made our way to the river and pushed off. The transfer tributary, called the Scrubber by the locals, was less than a mile downstream. We kept close to shore, hoping that the complex shoreline and shallow water vegetation would make it difficult for any aerial observer. Or, alternatively, that they'd be watching farther out. As we approached the Scrubber, we could see that a flotilla was set up, blocking the entrance. Quickly, we went ashore and started marching directly uphill. I didn't want to just follow the shore on land, as there would almost certainly be a land-based component to the blockade. I had to trust Quinlan's dislike of long hikes to ensure that we could go around everyone. I almost miscalculated it, though. Turns out I don't like hiking either, and made the decision to turn eastward just a little too early. Only the sound of voices raised in argument stopped us before we blithely walked into a guard post. We froze, glanced at each other, then edged into the bushes. The voices rose and fell in volume and emotion. It sounded like a difference of opinion about some obscure rule of a popular dice game. The guards were apparently handling the boredom with a bit of gambling. Hugh grinned but said nothing, and we changed our heading to go farther uphill. It was two bedraggled, waterlogged, and cranky Quinlan Mannies who dragged their butts out of the water at the other end of the Scrubber. I am never going in water again as long as I live, I said into the air. As a chemical substance, it is vastly overrated, Hugh agreed. Let's find a place to camp and get out of these wet Mannies. It wasn't that we were physically tired. That wasn't an issue with Mannies, but the constant running and the pounding we'd taken from even the milder stretches of river were mentally taxing. Even a post-human computer could finally have had enough. We set up a nest, made sure we were not visible, and popped back into VR. 26. Winding down. Bill, September 2334, Vert. I examined the star map in the holotank. Annotations attached to individual stellar systems indicated the current status of stations, autofactories, and public opinion. It wasn't good.
A few comms stations had been recovered, but in the end most had either successfully self-destructed or been nuked, probably out of frustration. Most auto factories had been recovered, but at the expense of significant downtime. The humans had put together their own software image, which they weren't sharing with us, and installed it on all human-controlled auto factories. It appeared the divorce was all but complete. Starfleet had succeeded in their goal, after a fashion, or maybe exactly in the way they'd intended. We hadn't ceased contact with humanity, but it would be through a much more narrow interface in the future. We no longer owned or controlled any comms stations and had very few auto factories anywhere in human-controlled space. This left the Bob-controlled systems naturally, but there was precious little of that, Epsilon Eridani and Alpha Centauri being the biggest examples. I remembered that one private conversation I'd had with Lenny. I hadn't discussed it with anyone, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to. It had been disquieting, but without any kind of possible resolution, just questions, no answers, at least not yet. I'd been doing some quiet poking around, and I had perhaps the first inklings of a possible explanation, but my ruminations were interrupted by a ping from Will. I invited him over, and he appeared a moment later. "Hi, Will, what's up? You remember the suggestion from Cranston that humans should claim and garrison all systems anywhere near New Pav?" "Yes, I hope your question isn't as ominous as it sounds." "Sorry, but yes. It's been approved by the UFS Council. They're going to start putting together expeditions to explore and claim as much as they can. It'll take a while, light speed being what it is," but I frowned. "Listen, Will, how many of those systems have been visited by Bobs?" "Most of them. But since we've had to isolate all the comms stations from BobNet, the UFS has deemed those systems to be abandoned and therefore fair game." "Oh, deemed, have they? Will we go along with that?" Will grinned in reply. "Funny you should ask. I've been talking to Oliver about it. He has a lot more free time than you, so I figured it would help to keep me off your back. Anyway, we can, with a little juggling, get nearby Bobs to most of those systems before the human expeditions, even if the humans were able to leave right away. And we'll instruct them to build a large and impressive military presence first thing, just in case the humans feel inclined to get pushy when they arrive."
"Okay, so we claim the systems. Why?"
"At the moment, more as a blocking tactic than anything," Will shrugged. "We don't, generally speaking, need the systems ourselves, but the PAV might. If we had the claim, we could sell them to the PAV for some nominal amount, saving face all around while very probably preventing escalating tensions." "Huh. Not a bad idea. You and Oliver will headman this?"
"Yeah, you seem busy enough."
I laughed.
"You ain't wrong."
"How's it going?" I hesitated before replying. "Well, the damage to human-replicant relations is pretty significant and probably long-term. And I guess Starfleet will consider that a victory. A lot of hardware has been taken down to get Starfleet out of our systems. The bad news being that we're taking them down. Yep, lots of rebuilding in our future, or in the humans' future. I don't get the impression we'll be invited to help."
"Peachy," Will stood. "Off to my next date from hell. Have fun."
"Yeah, that's what it is." 27. We've arrived. Bob, September 2334, Arcadia River System. The trip down the Arcadia was relatively uneventful. I attributed that partly to our extreme level of caution, and partly to the administrator's inability to cover absolutely everything. Our biggest danger at this point, other than being spotted, would be a very human tendency to throw caution to the wind and break into a sprint as we approached the finish line. Accordingly, we made a point of moving conservatively, staying close to shore and only traveling in the darkest part of the night. And eventually, we reached a familiar stretch of the river. We made our way to the shore and came up with a plan.
We'd hike in closer to Garrick's spine, then wait until dark to make for the transit station. "So how will we handle this?" Hughes said, gesturing to the backpack. "Maybe the fact that there are two of us will throw them off," I replied. "Plus, I've altered my appearance. Again, you probably aren't on anyone's radar yet." Hughes said nothing but leaned around me and peered at my backpack in an exaggerated manner. "I know it sticks out like a sore thumb, or like a backpack with a large cube in it. I wonder if I could pad it out or get a bigger pack." "I don't think there's any help for it," he replied. "We can't hide Bender's matrix. If we're seen carrying around a box big enough to conceal it, we'll probably be questioned anyway. At least the backpack gives us more mobility."
"At this stage, I don't think subtlety is going to be of much benefit."
"The run like hell portion of the program," I said with a small laugh. "That, and just going through at night, will be our biggest advantage." "True.
We have better night vision. Let's hope we don't run into Officer Friendly, though."
A quick glance at the sun confirmed we would be at Garrick's spine around nightfall if we left now and took it easy. It took slightly longer than expected to get to the town, so it was full dark by the time we arrived. As I always did, I stopped to admire the stellar display.
"That's just awesome," I said, pointing up at the heavens.
"Sure is," Hugh replied. "Interestingly, the constellations are accurate based on what the Quinlans would have seen from their planet. I love the attention to detail." We got our fill of the view and the few moments of zen before we crossed the city limits into the town proper. Garrick did not particularly go in for streetlights. Illumination from windows helped a little, but for the most part, you'd have to bring your own light if you were moving around at night. We did, in fact, see a couple of individuals walking along, holding lanterns above their heads. We avoided them on principle. There was no upside to getting noticed. The town was quiet, as befitted a society that rose and set with the sun. Occasional lowing sounds from hounds provided the only real breaks in the silence. But a couple of times we heard furtive sounds of movement with no attendant lantern light.
I wasn't interested in finding out the source. We consistently moved in the opposite direction.
Then, when we were about halfway through Garrick, a series of loud, popping sounds broke the nocturnal quiet. Both Hugh and I prairie-dogged, looking around with night vision turned up to max. There was no movement except a slight fog wafting through the streets. Wait.
Fog?
Fog required a specific set of meteorological circumstances to form, circumstances that were even more rare in Heaven's River, and we did not have that particular set of circumstances at the moment.
"I have a bad feeling," Hugh said, evidently having reached the same conclusion at the same time.
We started edging toward a side street, eyeballs darting in all directions at once. The separate images still disoriented me, so I frame-jacked slightly to ensure I could closely examine each view. Then, from the shadows of the adjoining streets, came several groups of Quinlans carrying pistols and wearing what could only be gas masks.
"I think we should leave," Hugh said.
"You think?" I growled. "Which way? Do you see an opening?"
"No, this looks very well planned. We may have to go up."
I followed Hugh's gaze. A series of leaps and grabs would place us on the roof of this one-story building. I couldn't tell anything from there, even with night vision. There wasn't enough light to make out how the building connected to its neighbors. But we didn't have a lot of options. Not bothering to comment, I leaped for the first hold and began hauling myself up. I could hear Hugh following me. I could also hear the pings of flechettes bouncing off the wall. None had struck me yet, but I couldn't tell about my backpack. Would the flechettes penetrate the material? Would they harm the matrix? With a snarl, I redoubled my efforts and popped over the top of the wall. I had a few moments of peace while the shooters concentrated their fire on Hugh. A few muttered curses showed he'd been hit. I thought I saw a way up to a nearby second-floor window, but I wouldn't know for sure until I was closer. Banging from street level made it clear that our pursuers were trying to get into the building whose roof we were currently occupying. We needed to be elsewhere. It was not the time for subtlety. I hit the wall to the next building, grabbed a few handholds, then pulled myself up using the windowsill. The window was partly open, and I butted the frame upward with my head, then pulled myself in. I spared a second to admire the athleticism of the Mannies. No Quinlan or human would have managed that feat. We were further advertising our existence by doing this, but I didn't see an alternative. There was a thump as Hugh rolled in behind me. We were in a bedroom, but there didn't appear to be any occupants. I opened the door and we snuck down the hall, trying to avoid any creaky boards. This appeared to be a rooming house. The second floor consisted of nothing but bedrooms and a bathroom. We tiptoed down the stairs at the end of the hall and peered around the corner at the bottom. What I supposed must be a common room took up the back half of the ground floor. There were four Quinlans sitting in chairs, all apparently sleeping. It would have been quite innocent, except one of the sleepers was slumped over in a most uncomfortable manner. "I think they've been knocked out," I said.
"The fog?"
"Yeah. I think there's a scattering going on."
"Well, I agree this is likely how they do a scattering, but I think they're after us, Bob."
"We have to get out of here." There was a back door in a small antechamber. I opened it and peered both ways. Nothing. We exited, carefully closed the door, and ran across the street and around the nearest corner, right into a group of mask-wearing Quinlans. We barreled into the group before we could stop or change direction. After that, it was just a matter of them getting their hands on us and holding on. I felt myself being pulled in several directions at once, and I realized I was going to have to really hurt people. Then several grips disappeared with cries of chagrin. "Get going, Bob, I got this," Hugh yelled as he wrapped his arms around several more of our attackers. I realized he was deliberately taking on the whole group, and it was working. I was down to two or three holds, a few twists, a gut punch, and I was free. I grabbed a loose gun and stuck it in my mouth. It seemed like a waste of time, since I'd had to get rid of the last one, but maybe I could figure something out. I dropped to all fours and sprinted down the nearest alley, determined to go right through anyone who got in my path. "Remember the failsafe, Hugh," I said over the intercom. "If it comes to that, Bob, but I may be able to talk my way out of this. Meanwhile, get Bender out of here."
Talk his way out?
I remembered my time with Natasha and company. More likely, he'd end up way too intimate with a sharp object. But I had to get to the station. I had a funny feeling that going straight west was going to involve dodging more Quinlans in masks. I glanced up, got my bearings, and adjusted my course to head for the hills. 28. Claiming Victory. Bill, September 2334, Vert. I gave a blat with the air horn, and the mass of Bobs gradually quieted to a ragged rumble. There would be no total quiet, though, if I was reading this crowd right. "Okay, a couple of reps from Starfleet will be here." I had to wait several mils for the insults and catcalls to die down. "And we're going to hear them out. Then we'll banhammer them," laughter greeted the last statement. I sent a text and Lenny popped in, flanked by a couple of other Starfleet members. The uniforms looked slightly different. I did a comparison with an earlier image and realized they'd toned down the TNG resemblance a bit. I wondered how much time and discussion had gone into that change. Now I got my silence. Not the respectful kind, but the kind where a crowd is sizing someone up. Lenny and friends felt it as well. They moved a little closer together. "All right, Lenny. Let's make this quick." Lenny nodded to me. "As a gesture of goodwill, we will release all remaining assets that are still under our control. We've accomplished what we set out to do." He was interrupted by laughter and jeers. Lenny took a moment to regroup, then continued. "We'll be setting up our own version of BobNet, our own backup site, and so on. I get that there's no repairing this, and honestly, I don't see us wanting to continue the association anyway. We'll give you a star map of our territory. You stay on your side, we'll stay on ours." I waited a few moments for the latest round of jeers and insults to subside. Then I said, "You haven't, you know, won. I mean, you did some damage, but it won't have the effect you were hoping for. What you did wasn't a strategy. It was just lighting things on fire to watch them burn." Lenny frowned. "We had an opportunity presented to us, and we had to make a choice. It wasn't ideal, but it was better than sitting around doing nothing except complaining at Moots. Lenny looked directly into my eyes for a moment, and an unspoken message traveled between us. There was more to this. It had to do with the private conversation we'd had, and he wasn't going to bring it up if I didn't. After a brief moment of silence, Lenny waved a hand in dismissal. Anyway, it's done. No point in obsessing about it, and with that, he and his fellows vanished.
That was kind of anticlimactic, Garfield said, as the background chatter increased to a shouting level.
Yeah. Interesting. I frowned and turned away. This would take some more thought.
29. Dodging. Bob, September 2334, Garrick's Spine. I got almost an entire block before I picked up a new set of pursuers. Six masked Quinlans turned and started after me as I ran past them. I heard the puff sound of trank guns being fired, but oddly didn't feel any impacts or hear the ping of flechettes bouncing off things. How bad was their shooting anyway? I turned an eyeball to look behind me, trying desperately not to fall flat on my face from the dual images coming in. I handed off the running activity to the internal AMI for a moment and concentrated on the view to the rear. It would appear that the resistance was involved. Two of the six Quinlans behind me were down on the ground, having been shot, and the other four were shooting back at something out of sight. I guess this was good to a certain extent, but in this case, the enemy of my enemy was still my enemy. I wondered briefly how they managed to tell each other apart. But only briefly, and I didn't let it distract me from the serious business of getting the hell out of there. I hit the edge of town and ran into the forest without breaking stride. I didn't know what tracking options they'd have. I could lower my body temperature once I stopped generating heat from exertion. I could turn off my scent. I performed the action as soon as I thought of it. I couldn't camouflage myself, not like the drones, but I could blend in with the forest when I stopped moving. I was, after all, brown. I had to make my way to the station, but I didn't have to take the direct route. Did the Quinlans know or suspect that I couldn't go by water? If not, they'd have to guard the river and stream approaches as well. But I couldn't afford to stop moving near the town. If they formed a search cordon, they'd flush me out, and going into hiding wasn't to my advantage. I had to get out of Heaven's River. I kept up the pace as long as I could, but eventually my heads-up started flashing warnings about overheating. It was okay, though. I was several miles out of town by this point, and the Quinlans would take twice the time to catch up with me, even if they knew exactly where I was. I sat down, took the trank gun out of my mouth, and began taking deep lungfuls of air. I didn't need the oxygen, but each breath carried away some waste heat. After a bit of fiddling, I found I could jam the gun into a webbing pocket on the side of the backpack. It wasn't ideal, but I didn't care at this point if someone saw that I was carrying a crew weapon. Time to take stock. Hugh, what's your situation? They've put me in manacles and commandeered a wagon. The hounds were groggy, but not unconscious. They're bellowing up a storm of protest, but doing what they're told. Where are you heading? Looks like the Eastern Station. I imagine I'll be going for a ride to meet someone. Okay, keep me updated. He would keep for a while. Bill, what's the situation? Just ended Moot. We had a talk with Starfleet. It was unsatisfying, let's say. Resolved nothing. Wow, that must have been interesting. Kind of sorry I missed it. You can read the transcripts. Meanwhile, I've been bringing myself up to date on your blog. Bender still okay? Matrix still in one piece, as far as I know. I just don't know how much jostling these things can take. It's not really part of the specs, you know? Yeah, got it, buddy. Well, take it easy. Hopefully we'll be able to talk later with a little less stress. And that was that. I didn't have an excuse to call Will or Howard, or even Marvin or Luke. With an internal sigh, I glanced at my heads up. Temps were down to something reasonable, although not yet baseline, but I could travel as long as I was relaxed about it. Time to go. The rest of the trip to the station was uneventful. I did half expect Quinlans to jump out from behind trees, especially as I got close, but Quinlans weren't forest creatures by nature.
I imagined that being in the trees and away from water would make them nervous. Finally, I could see the transit station through a gap in the forest. With freedom this close, I had to fight an urge to just break into a run. In any case, I wouldn't be going in through the front door, or the maintenance door. Fortunately, I had the hatch that Gandalf had. Uh-oh. A squad of Quinlans stood around the area of the hatch, holding shovels and discussing. Our secret entrance had been found. This was just getting worse and worse. I was literally a stone's throw from getting out, and every damned Quinlan on the planet had decided to show up here. But maybe they'd left the maintenance door open? Or maybe I could sneak in somehow. I didn't see any alternatives. Taking care to avoid rustling the foliage, I snuck around to the other side of the station. I arrived just as a Quinlan pressed her card against the reader and walked in through the maintenance door. I was too far to grab it before it closed, and anyway, that would be bad strategy until I knew more, but Quinlans were coming and going, and they had security cards. One way or another, I was going to make that work for me. I watched carefully, waiting for a moment when no one was in sight. I untangled the Trank gun from my pack, then crept up to the maintenance door. There was no discernible sound from the inside, but the wall construction was pretty thick. I might be able to peer through the front windows to see if anyone was in the lobby, and maybe, just maybe, I had enough fleas left to jimmy the lock. Without warning, the door burst open and a gaggle of Quinlans poured out, Trank guns drawn. I stared at the guns pointed in my direction. Crew or resistance? At this point, it didn't matter. Both groups were after me. This bunch was standing between me and the way out, and I decided I had just about had it. This was the time for a brute force response. I could take flechettes in the chest without critical damage. Bender's matrix was shielded by my body, and I had a full magazine. I was simply going to keep shooting them until I was the last man standing. I straightened up, Trank gun held out before me, and advanced on the group. This caused some consternation as several of them glanced backward with one eye to see if they were being snuck up on, and the rest settled into firing positions. Then one of the Quinlans held up a hand and yelled, "Hold on!" He cupped the other over his ear. I wasn't sure if he was gesturing at me or at his comrades. Judging from the expressions on their faces, they weren't sure either. The whole situation was straight out of a comic book. The battle was on hold while someone answered the phone, and it was definitely some kind of communication device because the conversation was two-way. The Quinlan would talk, then listen, then talk. A couple of times he rolled his eyes. I realized I was in an untenable position strategically. While I stared at the guy on the phone, other Quinlan